Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison Monthly Meeting. We're glad to have our speaker today, Leila Coleman. And we're going to have a question and answer period.
Well, Leila, thank you, and we enjoyed listening to you, your presentation this morning. And I'd like to ask a question. You work for the Madison Public Schools as a reading coordinator. And yet, your interest is in restorative justice. And I'd like to know what proportion of the students that are involved in or need to be involved in restorative justice programs have reading problems. And how do you work within the reading program to do restorative justice, or at least expand the coverage for students of restorative justice?
Yeah, great question. Thank you for starting with that. So I don't have any set data in my brain, but what I'll speak to is what my experience has been so far with, again, where I see the restorative justice approaches connecting in our school community and where I haven't seen them yet. So we have about a third of our, and this is a very rough generalization, but a third of our students, if we think about the third grade reading level and the measurements that we take every year, reading, at proficient levels in our community. And so that's a lot of students who aren't. And so one of the reasons I got into this work was, again, the background of learning to be a teacher of reading, and then when I was in the Madison community, I got back into Madison Public Schools and working with them because of what I was seeing with the achievement gap and the opportunity gaps that we've created in this community, and who we're providing access to and who we're not and why. And so as I got into that work, and this opportunity came up to me to be connected to reading once again, I actually saw it as a really intense issue around equity, right? So if we are not moving our students forward with the skills that they need to around reading, what does that look like for our community moving forward, and what does it look like for their lives? And so I would say that what I have seen as far as restorative justice practice in circles that are starting, I've seen a lot more at our secondary levels, so our middle school and high school. And I think that that's appropriate, and where students, you know, by that time, their sense of self is so much stronger. The concepts of moving from like sharing values and having a kind of intellectual level and then kind of moving down into spiritual level make more sense. But what I haven't seen is this type of structure and practice really specifically at our elementary schools. So I think about the students who are still struggling with reading at our elementary schools. I don't know if it's there. And there's lots of probably spaces where I don't know it exists, right, as I come into this work fairly new.
Likely it starts with learning to read in the first place.
Yeah. And I think about the concepts of setting up those learning communities, right, and how we really are creating those relationships. And there's a great work that's happening at the elementary schools, don't get me wrong. It's been fascinating for me to like open that door and learn and see some of our teachers do, the structures that they use. There's time on carpet, right? We're all connected as a small community. There's time where they do all kinds of interesting things as small groups and pairs. But something like this, like a restorative justice circle, I don't know how many of our students who struggle with reading when they're really young are getting it. The other thing I would say, just to add and then to end on that, is I think in our special education population, which again is where my work around professional development for teachers and reading interventions and reading supports lives, I think that it's a struggle for all those students to truly be included. Madison prides itself on inclusion and inclusivity for all students, and special education students are not an exception, but I do find that they've often been taught over here, like in another different space, versus always in that same classroom and community. And so when I think about being really connected to that and creating that community, I think that that difference of space is something that is always has to be thought of first, and that they need more connection than maybe that they're getting everywhere.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Can you talk about circle keepers? What does that responsibility entail?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's something that I'm, again, kind of have moved through some training for, and I'm starting to explore more, and it happens. One of the reasons I thought about Prairie and bringing restorative justice circles here is, well, the language we talked about earlier today, inherent dignity and worth for all. But also that concept of a circle and the rhythms of it being so entrenched in a community that again, thinks about worth. So a circle keeper is someone who's really facilitating that, right? So very much someone who, again, may kind of introduce what the topic or the theme might be, right? So if it's a circle to repair harm, they might provide some of, again, just the context. They're also going to kind of ensure that everyone gets equal voice. So even starting with like the structure, we are actually in a circle. Kids especially will try to, right, like kind of haphazardly put chairs next to each other in a clump and, you know, but the structure is really important. So maintain that structure, validating the voices that you hear. There is a talking piece, so a physical item that is passed around. So a circle keeper would start with that. They might choose something that's really of importance to that community. I have a world's greatest educator statue that looks like an Oscar that a student gave me once. So I bring that often, like, because I feel like every educator I'm in my presence should feel like they're the world's greatest teacher at some moment, even if it's just for that minute that they're in the circle.
And you have to be holding that to speak.
You have to be holding that to speak.
You have that connection with social justice about the food system.
Yeah, absolutely. And that where that starting comes from it. Yeah, and to spiral back, the circle keepers also, too, would maybe do some reflection between questions. So typically in a circle, a structure, we might have four rounds, maybe, right? So we're maybe stating our beliefs around why we're here, and we're checking in. And so after each round, a circle keeper will probably reflect or maybe synthesize what has been said. That's always something that's really fascinating for me, as I like that type of thinking on the fly, to try to like synthesize what we've all said as a large collective. So, and then a circle keeper might also at the end then, when we think about what the point is of all of this, is to help reinforce and kind of paraphrase that action that might be taken next, right? So whether that's, you know, now this is a norm we've created in our community and we're going to uphold that norm, or we know that there's further conversations that have to happen to try to undo the harm, and those might happen next. So they kind of paraphrase that whole experience. And there's often two circle keepers, actually, is what is an interesting, if you have a larger group, like a small circle, not necessarily, but if you had a group of 40 or 50 people, which definitely could happen, or in a classroom, you might have two people circle keeping. One other thing is that students are starting to be circle keepers in our schools. So they're moving through the training as well. So it's not just adults holding
great.
That role.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
It can continue on better then.
Yeah, absolutely, right? And if I see my peers do it, how much more powerful that is than if I see an adult do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Since bullying is a big factor in what's going on in schools and stuff, do you find much bullying in, you know, what you're doing? And if you find bullying, how do you handle that in those situations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really fascinating thing. I've been... to be really transparent with everyone, I've been in more circles with adults than I have with students, but I've been in you know, a good handful with students as well, and high school students. I've never been with little ones. When I've seen high school students do that, right, where we're in a circle, we're moving through a process, and they start to, again, usually it's like a lot of verbal aggression, or they're verbally agitated, and sometimes directing that at another student in the room. That is another role of the circle keeper, is just to remind and come back to norms. And I think the important thing to say there, too, is that as this process starts, and students especially, but all adults and humans learn about it, that we have some norms and values of that process that we try to follow and move through. So they'd be reminded of that and come back to that. And then the talking piece, that physical piece, is actually the really important thing. To know, because sometimes, right, if I'm trying to be assertive or aggressive at another person, they're wanting to talk back at me, right? the one thing I found actually really fascinating about this process is if it's like rooted in what the students do, like if this isn't their first circle, right, they've been moving through processes like this frequently, or they have a classroom where this is kind of, again, the norm of how they handle life in their classroom, they respect those pieces, and they can really speak from a place of hurt or anger too, and the reminder of it not coming back at a person, but saying like, I was really angry when so-and-so did this to me, right? Like, so they, their feelings can be validated. So I think it almost gives a third point to it at times that they don't have otherwise, right? When I'm just talking about, again, the student who, again, got in my face and was, you know, is bullying and talking to me. It's not always effective, like anything, right? There's no magic bullet, we like to say, in education. So sometimes students aren't in a place where a circle is appropriate, right? Sometimes people try to do it too soon. One thing to note is that if an incident has just happened, it's not usually a space to, like, let's go find ourselves in a circle 10 minutes later.
Does it always have to be labeled a circle?
Yeah, great question. Not always. And sometimes this process, I mentioned our social workers, our school social workers, and this morning, and they might do that with two or three students, right? But they're going to move through the same process. And if the kids are familiar with it, they might call it a circle, or they might not. They might just organically, like, move through. Especially if they're moving through with a family, too, right? We think, most families might not have had this language or this exposure, and so to think about how you help to move someone through a process if this is brand new to them, they might not call it, like, we're going to formally move in through a circle, and here's a talking piece. But they might apply all the principles and try to, again, use that structure, if you will.
Mm-hmm. What age have the kids become circle keepers? Is this more a high school, or can the young kids do that?
Great question, Barb. I actually don't know if there's any middle school students who are. I wouldn't be surprised if they were, but I actually don't know. I know we have high school circle keepers at all grade levels, so by the time they're in high school, that's something that our students might be able to access. But I don't know about middle school.
How does an issue get to a circle? Is someone a teacher refer, a student refer?
If it was a circle to repair harm or any. Yeah. So there's lots of different structures in our schools that, and again, I'm speaking from such a, like, a kind of high up view of this sometimes, that, but we have PBIS coaches, what we call positive behavioral support coaches in our buildings. So that's a title that you might have heard in the past somewhat time, and we sometimes have these too, but dean of students, or an individual who handles behavioral incidents or student behaviors in a school. Also our school social workers, and then other staff that we might call student support staff. So like at our high schools, when you have, you know, 2,000 plus kids in a space, there's lots of different adults that are holding these student support roles. And so what might happen is that if, let's say a fight broke out in the hallway, that as administrators we're helping to move through and that incident, right, and talking to kids and connecting, whoever is supporting the students might suggest and say, let's provide a circle to try to repair harm here. And then it might be, again, a school social worker, it might be the positive behavioral support coach, it might be a restorative justice coach, that, because we have a few from the district level that come in and support and lead that. There might be a whole bunch of different adults that help kind of initiate that. So it can come from a lot of different places. Some, as you could imagine, right, as this type of approach rolls out in a space the size of Madison and other districts as well, there's some buildings that latch onto that because the culture kind of supports that already, and there's some buildings that don't. So we also will have a variance of how circles are used across a community, like in the organization like Madison Metropolitan, and the same is true for other districts. As I mentioned, Oakland Unified School District this morning, and that's when we're like one building, one high school really dove into this work before lots of others did, as they kind of played with it a little bit. So that happens pretty frequently as communities use these approaches.
I can think this up my next question, which was how is this being taught and disseminated in an organization as big as the public school?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, there were people doing this you know, long before, like, we got that language, like, in 2014, and there was lots of reflection kind of at a national level and down through policy-wise around what these more punitive approaches to especially behavior in schools were doing to students, right? Who was actually receiving more suspensions or expulsions? Why? What type of barriers that was creating? So, again, we've had strong restorative justice practices in this community for, you know, as long as anyone has, right? The YWCA has done a wonderful, amazing program and trains lots of staff. And so there's been teachers or people always that have kind of, like, used this a little bit. But I think the thing that really drove it was in 2015, the behavior education plan was implemented. And again, there might be some facts that I don't hit on the head here because I wasn't in that work. But my, as I watched it, 2015-16 school year, that was rolled out as a response to basically the suspension and expulsion rates for our students of color were extremely disproportionate to, again, the percentage of students of color in our buildings, right? So if, you know, we had 100 suspensions, you know, 95 of them would be for students of color, and those students of color made up 40% of the building. So, and as I'm really thinking about, again, coming back to that achievement gap and the opportunity gaps we've created in the schools in this in Madison, the behavior education plan was a response to that. And so I first started to see and learn about the restorative justice work building out of that, because if we change the approach, there had to be another approach, right? And so this was one of the approaches that started. So again, the work happened much definitely before that, but I think that was impetus to start to expand it. So we have multiple people that have been kind of, again, in charge of building out that kind of plan. What does that mean for schools? What does that mean for training? And we've had outside consultants, organizations coming and working with Madison to kind of lift that up. And that was one of the things I got to take advantage of as the opportunity to really kind of come as a person who works at the central office level and is really interested in this, but doesn't see it fit into every part of my day-to-day job. How can I come and learn how to be a circle keeper and learn where and how this fits in our spaces? So I think, like many things in a district this size, it happens slowly and it happens bit by bit. And it did happen from our high schools kind of out is what I've experienced and seen. La Follette High School's actually had the strongest connection to restorative justice practices initially. Like they had the kind of the strongest work in that building first, and then it's expanded. So I would say all of our buildings are at different levels, but one teacher at a time is probably what they would say too.
Do you deal with conflicts between teachers and students?
Yes, that's a huge use of circle. Actually, the multiple circles that I've been in with students have usually been about that. Like, this teacher has been disrespectful to us. This teacher has been not listening to us. Like, they're asking us to do things that, again, the teacher feels disrespected. The students feel disrespected. Everyone feels like a mess. And so the times that I've been into support, that's been like the scenario. Sometimes it's a change of teacher, right? So maybe we've had a community of students that as a cohort are moving through and a teacher changes and then they aren't connecting. Yeah, everything changes. And sometimes it's been new students come in, right? So there's a class and maybe four or five new students come in and there's issues and as far as dynamics and relationships. But yes, I think it's actually one of the most effective things I've seen when that's happened, when there's teacher and student issues. And then there's also, I know, small circles where, again, some of our support staff, like a social worker or PBS coach would maybe, again, have a student and a teacher in a circle with them, right? So as a third point or a facilitator to try to repair that harm or build that relationship. That happens quite a bit.
So students are beginning to feel they're going to be heard.
That is our hope, always, right? I think when I'm really frank about education, there's lots of places where they don't feel heard, and there's lots of places where they feel like they don't belong. Mm-hmm. But I think there are lots of places, there's lots of adults trying to change that, and I think there's lots of spaces where that is changing.
Mm-hmm. What about the parents of the students? Mm-hmm. I assume you work with them, and what kind of response do you get from parents?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so that's something, again, for transparency's sake, I haven't been connected to personally, but what I know happens, a great example of it is like a readmittance meeting. So if a student is, again, suspended, or there's an incident, they have a fight, they're not able to attend school for multiple days, that readmittance meeting is often, often held as a circle now. So asking the parents to come back, to come in at a time, asking an administrator, so an assistant principal or principal. Again, there's usually like a support staff, like a social worker or coach, the students.
If it was an incident involving other students, are they invited frequently?
Yeah, so if it was incident involving many students collectively, they all might be in one circle, or they might have meetings separately, depending on the dynamic.
But students that were asked to not attend school,
mm-hmm.
others that were involved that weren't asked not to attend, are those involved?
Yeah. Okay. So but I think, the dynamic and the intention usually, and again, it's not perfect, I know it doesn't happen always, but the intention is really to think about how those actions caused harm and to who, and then think about that interconnectedness of we're all humans in this space together and in this school community together. And so I think about like what I give new teachers or tutors or others as advice, when there's a bully in town, don't validate the bully. You validate whoever is being acted upon. And so it's also, I think, a sense of that, of how do we lift up the voices of those who were harmed by the incident or action, but also how we help to understand and kind of deconstruct why that harm occurred or why the actions occur. And so everyone can do it collectively.
What happens when, let's say, you're going to have this meeting and the parent is invited mm-hmm. to participate? What if the parent refuses to participate? I mean, basically, teachers can't refuse to, and students, because they go to school there, but mm-hmm. the parents.
It kind of happens, right? It definitely mm-hmm. happens. I think then the point of all of that is to really try, to use that example that we started with there, is to readmit that student into a community and to allow them to feel like they have support. So no matter what I just did, right, that I'm not an awful, evil human. I probably made a mistake, especially as a young person, and that there's still a community that will be there to support. And I think that's what got lost when we have this punitive, more zero tolerance policy, right? I make a mistake, I get sent home, I come back, but no one really cares about me. So I think when families aren't involved, or parents, when there's no representation there, that it's still, how can the adults in the room really help the student feel like there is a reason for you to be here every day, and the reason that we do support you, and here's how we're going to support you, and kind of lay that out. Obviously, it's stronger if both a family and the school can do it collectively. But again, just providing that, I think, is usually the intent.
But that, the parent not participating, would kind of give you an indication of some of the problems that the student is having because of the behavior of the parent.
It might, for sure. Yeah, and I think when I think about that, one thing I've learned in this work is really thinking about those multiple truths that, a parent that never shows up at school might also love their child unconditionally and want the best for them. Or a parent that is uncomfortable to go into a school building might also be incredibly supportive of them emotionally at home. So I think it's a challenging thing that I've had to wrestle with as a former teacher, right, when parents wouldn't show up or wouldn't communicate.
Well, it also includes parents who are economically unable to come when the school wants them to come.
You got it, right? You got it. So to think about those different, all those different levels and things, which, again, just trying to hold those as true, and that there's multiple things happening always for parents and families, I think it's one of those things I've had to reflect on a lot and think about and say, like, great, just because those parents I worked with long ago wouldn't show up for this meeting or wouldn't communicate doesn't mean that they don't also want the very best for their child.
Well, sometimes isn't it a matter of that the parent is in denial about that their child has a problem?
I would say I'm sure that absolutely times, happens too. Yeah.
It's not just that, but it's mm-hmm. other things that the parent is like, no. My child is fine and I love them.
And I think that I think our support staff deal with a lot of that as far as like that entitlement piece too of my students should have something different, right? That if this is something we ask all students to go through, I don't want mine to. I want them to do something different. So yeah, that's definitely a dynamic that comes out in these pieces too. And parents that are really, really involved, right? So we have parents that aren't involved at all and parents that are uber involved, that are like, want to be in all of the situations at all times because that's how they parent. So
control.
So thinking about those two spectrums aside and everything in between, right? When you when you're working with families in the community.
Yeah. How do you deal with parents who want something special for their kid?
It's a great question. I deal with this question all the time, actually, when it comes to reading and reading instruction. I think for me, the thing that I try to hold really in front of me is that value of public education and that every student is... I firmly believe this, entitled to a free and appropriate public education. Mm-hmm. And that I think there's a lot of parents, often when a parent wants that, they're a parent who is able to provide so much more for their child than many of the other children sitting next to theirs.
So they have a kind of a mindset of expecting more.
Exactly. And so when you have the resources to provide more, whatever resources that is, if it's emotional, financial, there's all kinds, right? If you're able to provide so much more for your child, but then you're asking more, is to be really, really open to hearing that feedback and asking why and kind of understanding why they want more and then trying to determine if that's appropriate or not. And that's a really tough question, right? There's a lot of gray and there's a lot of variance. Sometimes a child needs something that's specialized or unique, and that can be appropriate. Sometimes a parent wants something that isn't going to be appropriate for that collective. So it's a really challenging question, and I think it's one our principals and administrators deal with a lot, and many of us who work in a more central level like I do deal with a lot.
How have you seen those proportions of kids getting expelled? Pushed out discipline-wise, mm-hmm. as mm-hmm. opposed to the circle.
Mm-hmm.
Have we seen a decrease in that in the public school?
We have. We definitely have. And the numbers, especially our high schools, and I don't have them in front of me, so my apologies, but I have definitely decreased. One caveat there is that because of the structure of how we approach behaviors change, I know that some of our educators would say that while our numbers are different, we're not seeing a shift hugely in what behavior looks like in our schools. So how we classify it or how we label it or mark it, right, might have shifted sometimes, but is it being disruptive or supportive of students? In some spaces that has definitely decreased as well, and in some spaces it hasn't. So that's a really interesting concept to me, right, and thinking of like, so we change a structure and we change an approach, and there's beliefs and values behind that approach, but if we don't change those beliefs and values, we're just going to name it something different and kind of play the game, if that makes sense. Again, not a magic bullet, right?
Not useful.
Yeah, but at the same time, if we think about how many students' voices have been heard in a circle process that weren't 4, 5, 7 years ago, that to me is a huge win. Right. And so when you think about where students are really able to say honestly and openly, like, again, express emotion, like, you know, and their voice is heard and validated, say, I don't feel like I belong here, you know, say all the things that they often don't have an opportunity to say, and say that with peers and with adults. I think that has been the shift that I've started to hear, just the rumblings, right, culture wise. That we're valuing that in a different way.
Do you work with community centers here in Madison? And if you do, some of the students are probably, when they get involved in the community center, do you see a change in when they get involved, like with the community centers?
That's a great question. I know the restorative practices like team, those are the people that lead the work kind of the whole district wide, they work really, really closely with the YWCA. And then they work closely with, as I mentioned, some other outside organizations. Also a little bit different, but the National Equity Project is also a national organization that has come in and provide a lot of different language and supports around kind of shifting to this work. As far as when students are in the community, that I don't know, right? How that shifts as far as their connectedness then to those organizations. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot more intercrossed kind of connections with adults of other community based organizations as students move through circles. And I think that's been really valuable, right? They're meeting other adults in different parts of the community, and they're working with other adults that aren't necessarily always just a teacher. And there's a lot of cross. Yes.
That's why I was going to ask. Yes. Because I live near the Goodman Community Center, and a lot of children participate, and it seems that children get very involved over there.
Absolutely. I was actually there on Thursday to work with some teachers as one of our alternative mm-hmm. programs is like kind of house now in the new Brassworks building.
Yeah.
I don't know if anyone's been, but it is amazing. Yeah. But yeah, so the... But yeah, so that then what happens, right, when you're in that space or connected, well, the opportunities you have then, I think it just unfolds and opens more doors is what I've seen. But again, I haven't had any real personal experience with what the how it's open for the students.
I was talking to somebody that volunteers over there. Mm-hmm. And he mentioned one of the kids that volunteers there mm-hmm. and what a change he has made. Mm-hmm. You know,
positive change.
Yeah, a positive change. This one child has really come out and gotten involved.
Yeah, and one thing exciting about that is that, you know, school isn't for everyone, right? And so sometimes students need an opportunity to thrive in other spaces. Mm-hmm. And so I think of that about experiential learning is something in previous positions I learned about and talked about. We explored a lot with kids and if there's more crossover to that through structures like that, that's just only a positive for our kids.
Years ago, I had a friend whose daughter went to Shabazz,
mm-hmm.
and she said the reason her daughter went to Shabazz, her daughter was very smart and got very good grades, but she went there because she didn't want to be at East High School. She wanted a different environment to go to high school,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know if you work with Shabazz, is it even in existence anymore?
It is, and it's attached to Sherman Middle School.
Right.
I think they share that same space. Yep,
it's still there.
It is. Yep, and still one of the alternative programs.
Are there any other specialized high school programs?
There are. There's so Capital High is the name of one, and Shabazz High School are kind of alternative high schools. And there's also alternative programs that are always shifting and changing a little bit to the point that I don't even know the titles of all of them because they shift a little bit in kind of response to students who are more of our high needs as far as support students, whether that means behavioral or special education, academic, like there's lots of different ways and reasons why. But there's one called SAIL, East, West, there's lots of different connections with...
City school used to be.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what happened to
city school. Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned... the list, I can't even tell you the names of all. And there's some that I support teachers there and some that I don't, too.
Well,
that they liked about it was that they had a meeting in the beginning of every day with all the student body present
mm-hmm.
and able to talk and share issues.
Yeah, so that community feels different, right?
Yeah. Years ago, I didn't know the Goodman Center had an actual school in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at the open house, and I was talking to one of the staff people there, and she said, oh, yeah, we have a school here. And I go, you have a school here? I didn't know that. I mean, it's more obvious now than years ago. But,
mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's more and more of that all the time. It's so much bigger than my lens within and we think about a district this size, too. Like, but there's a lot of connection with community-based organizations and a lot of just, again, movement of how are we trying to create spaces that are best for kids that look different than especially our comprehensive high schools, but also our elementary and middle schools, too.
While students are suspended, are there any circles available while they're suspended?
That's a great question. I actually don't know the answer to that.
Because you have to provide education at home while they're suspended, right? Public schools have to continue education in some way.
I believe, again, when that's sending home and communication of what's being, like, we can't just say, like, oh, sorry, you're 2 weeks behind, right? So, like, that communication flow has to still happen, and everything's on digital these days, so it's, like, the access is pretty streamlined there. So I actually don't know the new policy around, like, what teachers and have to do for students. But I don't know if they have offers of circles before that readmittance kind of meeting. That's the key time that I know about. It's a really good question.
a question, Leila. I was really impressed with the when you were presenting this morning, that whole concept of kids needing to feel like they belong in this space, they own the space, and how many kids, I'm betting, don't. So are these circles being implemented in the very, very young grades when kids are developing that sense of this is a safe space, this is my space, this is home, this is where I belong? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've touched on it a little bit, but I actually have not had experience, great experience with it at our elementary schools. I've seen it in action so much in our high schools and middle schools. I do know for sure we have staff that are trained in this, you know, again, at our elementary level. And the structures at elementary school are much more of about that we all belong in different ways, but as true like circle practices, I'm actually not sure. The one thing that in the piece that's it's really connected with, and I keep thinking about, so the Madison School, the African-American student kind of union or committee presented last year to the school board around thinking about what they were not getting as a student body and what they needed. And the two things that came out, the two things that came out were sense of belonging and relationships with teachers. So I think that the pieces that, when I think about that belonging question, the thing that really comes up for me is really about thinking about how do we start it as young as you're asking, right? Like, how do we have this, like, conversation with them when they're in second and third grade? Because we know it starts, right?
They should start that early, don't they?
Yeah. For sure. That's where that sense of comfort begins.
Right.
The first day they walk into the school.
I have a question, and these are groups where the participants are expected to reveal quite a bit about themselves. How do they have any assurance that revelation won't come back to bite them?
That's a great question. I think it's that building of trust. And so the one thing I regretted about presentation this morning is that the way I've learned is one of the best ways to start to learn about circle is to experience circle and to experience it in a very low risk manner, right? So ideally, if we first were investigating circles, we would participate in one that was pretty low stakes, right? That would ask and say, like, you know, again, one of the congregation members was saying, like, that actually they did some structures at the school her child attends, and they said, what do you love about your child? You know, a question that was started with. Or, again, if we were here today doing it, maybe we would start with, you know, tell me that story concept, right? The story that I started with. Talk to me about you and your story. Because I think, and this is still where I'm still such a learner in this work, but I think the concept of story is what creates that interconnectedness in circle and that trust that you speak to, right? That it's not going to come back and bite me, right? That's an okay space. So I'm going to tell my story, and I can feel like I'm a little bit vulnerable because I know you're going to tell your story. And we choose to how much we tell, right? And at first, we're probably just going to tell just a little bit.
And is the anonymity verbally expressed when you form a circle the way it is in many groups?
I would say that yes, there are norms and, like, you know, kind of rules of the land that establish first.
How well can these damaged, injured children understand the rules and not use this tool that they have? Oh,
yeah,
have something on so and so.
Right. I think that's why you start at that base of that triangle, and you have to form those relationships and that trust. Because I think if you try to go up and do the repair harm, I think exactly what you're speaking to, why would I trust that? Or maybe I'll play the game and move through it, but why would I support that?
I assume one of the problems is trying to figure out the best questions to ask people. Because everything is potentially loaded.
Yeah.
What do you love most about your child?
Sure.
You could be running into, I hate this kid, and whatever.
Yeah.
So is it a better question to say, what do you like best about your child?
Yes, sure. And language that matters,
and
right?
And I don't know whether that's a good substitute or
you
not.
Either. I thought it was a fascinating thing to hear from a, you know, again, another person speaking to their experience today. You know, ones that I've heard a lot of why questions be asked as far as in the values and beliefs rounds of thinking of starting a circle. And then there's reason there's the rounds too, right? So we check in. Like we speak to who we are, or we introduce ourselves if we're new to each other, and then we kind of check in, maybe checking even into our bodies that day, right?
So what's the difference between these circles and an AA meeting?
I've never participated in AA meetings, so I don't know if I've seen movies or read about them. So I would say that, again, a complete guess, but I would say that the thinking I have is the sameness would be community, right? The sameness would be transparency to the level that you feel is comfortable for you.
And a check-in.
The sameness would be, again, thinking about my voice is equal here with all the other voices. I kind of have a sense that that might be true. I don't know, but an AA meeting. And I think different is like there might or might not be at that kind of structure action after, right? What am I going to take action around?
The prescribed list of these are the things, the steps,
sure,
et cetera,
sure.
I'm sure is a real difference. But
yeah, but like the, you know, what we're going to do today after, like what am I going to do tomorrow to help build this harm that happened in our teacher community? Or I don't know if people in that like an AA structure walk away with what I'm going to do tomorrow specifically that's different than my checklist. But I don't know.
One piece I'd be curious about that could be a difference or could be the same, I'm not sure, is that, you know, part of the reason, the point of AA is that it's like this regular thing that happens. But the circles, is it like it's kind of a one and done, or is it like we feel a need to return, or
mm-hmm.
two or three? Or
mm-hmm. Yeah, I think everyone is using it differently. I think the one thing that's dangerous if it's a one and done and it's like there to repair harm, right? So
mm-hmm.
You can say if we all just met each other for the first time today and then something happened and then the policy of Prairie was if it happened on site, we had to have a circle about it, but we didn't know each other and it had been their first one. It'd be very, very different than if we were in a trusted community where we did the circle four or five times. Again, I think that low risk to high risk piece is really important. I do this all the time because I'm doing professional development with adults a lot, right? And I want them to feel a sense of that community or a psychologically safe space. So we have to start with a thing like, you know, what's the most disgusting thing you've ever eaten? And that's a middle school question, right? But I would ask that to middle schoolers to get them to laugh, right? Which you did, thank you. So, and to start to get them talking. And then I'd say, you know, we'd build up maybe to, what's one thing that's really, really challenging for you at school? That's a high-risk question.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we want our circles to go, but I can't start there.
No.
So why, maybe I ask, maybe our circle is about
getting to
the most disgusting thing we've ever eaten first. And so that, I think, you know, like any work of humans and people work, right? You have to move within the, some groups move really fast and some you have got to build that for a long time. Like I've been in a space where
continue to meet.
Yes, I would say you can continue to meet, but not necessarily. When I worked on this training, I was in a space for 2 days with people who had never met each other and people dove in real, real fast. They were committed to this type of work, obviously, right? But students in like a classroom, maybe I'd have it every week. Maybe we'd do circle. So there's lots of things like that.
When you have restorative circles in a school, is it held in the library or some room that's neutral in some way, or is it held in a classroom?
Mm-hmm. It depends on the school. Some spaces there are a space that's like the room for circles, like a neutral space. It's nobody's classroom. Sometimes those rooms are often used for mindfulness as well. So again, maybe there's components of that. And then some spaces, it just happens in a classroom.
Do you want to speak to that issue about mindfulness?
Sure, sure. And then what about me about time for us to wrap up about 4 or 5? That's actually how I kind of got connected to any of this. So it's a great question. Thank you to kind of wrap up. I was looking for different ways to kind of shift what I was seeing in my work in education. and have a yoga practice myself. So was experiencing some mindfulness and starting to explore that a little bit through that movement, mindful movement. And then I got an opportunity to participate in Breathe for Change, which is a yoga teacher certification program that was designed primarily for educators. So it's 200 hours of training. And again, the point is often to become a yoga teacher, but it's mainly more about educators and bringing some of the principles and practices of that to yourself and just for self-care for educators as you're moving through that type of work. And that opened doors to me more about mindfulness and mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is kind of where the research lies and is kind of the language used in the more medical side of things. So, for instance, UW Health, there's a ton of programming around mindfulness-based stress reduction. So exploring that a lot more and exploring more opportunities for mindfulness practice connected to our district. So I was exploring this, and these opportunities kept coming up, and I eventually started to help lead some small bits of practice with others. Again, I consider myself a incredible novice around this, but I'm just doing more and more. As we're finding that those practices are really, really important when it comes to things like teachers examining their implicit bias, when it comes to self-care, when it comes to pause before reaction, reactivity, right, around students and scenarios and with students. So I'm now on the Core Mindfulness team, which is just a name for a group of educators from all different types of job titles who helps drive mindfulness work in the Madison Metropolitan School. So that means I just help lead some things, and I participate in lots of things, and I still get to do learning with UW Health and other places.
And is that building an awareness?
Yeah, so I'm starting still building awareness and then offering opportunities for people to practice. Mm-hmm. And then that is actually what got me connected to exploration within restorative justice work too, because I see so many parallels and so much connectivity there. So as I mentioned, I think there's more exploration for me to do as I'm just at the beginning, but felt like something that this community would be really interested and receptive to. So that's kind of how we got here today.
I have a quick question. Do you use a lot of this in your own personal life?
I do.
That's what I thought.
I do. I have a brain that needs it in order to slow down. I don't know if it stops ever. I don't know if I've ever experienced it stopping, but slow down to process and to be, again, just in a space that's okay. And especially doing the work that I do, I feel like it's important for me, for my balance.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
Well, thank you very much, Layla.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.